there and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb and I'm joined by just my father, Dr. Scott Keith. For those who are listening closely, this is emergency episode number 2 of 2020 with probably a few more to come. You know, this just happens throughout the year. One of the blessings of working for 1517 is that we don't always work from a centralized office. We can do a lot of our work from home, which for me has been a particular blessing in balancing also my wife's work schedule and watching the kids and that sort of freedom. But with that freedom also comes sometimes some emergency work that has to be done wherever you are. And in this case, we are not in the studio. We are in a cabin in the middle of the San Bernardino National Forest in Southern California and staring at a bunch of snow and icicles. And I'm a little covered in mud. Are you covered in mud?
Well, I wasn't under the truck as much as you were. So.
And in addition to doing some emergency recording, we finished an emergency oil change on a, 6.8 liter Duramax?
6.6
liter Duramax engine where I took a little bit of an oil bath and definitely a lot of mud. It's a weird thing doing an oil change in the snow. But regardless, today we're going to do a Q&A episode. We get, you know, lots of questions into the show from email and Facebook and Twitter, and they just come in. And one of the goals I have is I try to answer a lot of them by email. I can't get around to all of them. Some of them I don't make it onto the show because either the subject matter is something we've done a bunch or it's something that doesn't lend itself to conversation on the show. It's just better as sort of giving somebody a straightforward answer. But today I'm going to try to look at a handful of questions that can be easily answered on the show. It might be helpful to more than just that particular individual who's asking it. And I don't know. The rest of this is just going to be maybe talking about what's going on. So
yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so first question. This is a great question, actually. Because it's one we've answered, but I think we can answer again. We have a friend of the show who wrote in and said, hey, he's had some coworkers actually come to him and say that they're interested in finding some sort of deeper meaning in their lives, meaning some sort of spirituality or religion. And he's wondering, he's been trying to help them find things to read, listen to, etc. Do we have any suggestions? He's, you know, suggested things like Mere Christianity, be in there. I think he also said The Case for Christ in there. So seems like an apologetic bent to it. Are there any other things we would suggest that would help these friends of his make the leap to the truth, is how he put it.
Oh, okay. So if I'm understanding this correctly, it sounds like this person is not a Christian and they're asking sort of a wide open question about meaning in their life, and our listeners trying to point them to the ultimate truth and meaning.
Yeah, he says, to plainly put it, this person has zero knowledge of the subject matter.
Well, I'm kind of reminded of when Mom and I were talking to Emma, and she was out of the faith, and she had had several apologetic conversations with her boyfriend at the time. But the apologetic conversations were kind of stalled a little bit because she just had no basic knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to be sort of a cliche answer for Thinking Fellows, but we took her to Luther's Small Catechism because beyond it just being a great instructional book for the Christian faith, which is, of course, what it was designed to be, it walks you through the basics of the faith. You're going to get the Ten Commandments, the Creed, Ten Commandments with explanations, the Creed with explanations. You'll get teachings on the sacraments with explanations, the Lord's Prayer with explanations. And you'll kind of get the daily motion of the Christian life and the basics of belief that every Christian should hold, which is, of course, why he wrote it in the first place. And that, you know, when we were talking with Emma, that pretty much did the trick. That's what brought her around. And in any modern edition of Small Catechism, you'll not only get, say, the commandments and the meanings from Luther, but you also get Bible verses that are laced throughout that'll tell you where these things can be found. So I would recommend Luther's Small Catechism.
Cool.
Surprisingly enough.
Yeah, I actually thought that that's how you were probably going to answer that question. I think it's a really good addition. I mean, since our listener already said he's been, you know, given them some apologetic material already, you know, we could probably add a little bit to that list, although I would say those are two very good introductory apologetic books.
I mean, if he's already given Mere Christianity,
yeah,
you know, Mere Christianity and the Small Catechism and be available for questions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because, you know, sometimes for somebody who seems like this person he's dealing with is already open-minded enough if they're asking that question, right? And so maybe the answer is something more doctrinal, which would get them to meaning maybe sooner than Case for the Resurrection directly.
Yeah.
Especially if that is about, like, why does my life matter sort of questions. The Small Catechism gets to that pretty quickly, both in the, you know, the outline of the Ten Commandments.
Right.
But also really particularly within the Creed and how your life matters to God, matters to your neighbor, was redeemed, even though sometimes it feels like
it's unredeemed.
Yeah, unredeemed, or even though you may not see meaning in your life because of sin, and it sort of dumps into that. And so there's some level of not only explanation, but sort of addressing that direct comfort question of, does my life have meaning? Which may be a lot for this particular person. It's hard to tell. I'm not there having the conversation. So like you said, I think just being, and it sounds like this listener is open to this, just being available in and outside of work, even, to be able to answer these questions seems like probably the best course of action.
Yeah, I mean, Mere Christianity and Small Catechism will get you a long way. Mere Christianity was sort of intended to do that for people who didn't know a whole lot about Christianity and were maybe not Christian. The Small Catechism was intended to do that for people who didn't know a lot about Christianity and were Christian. And so,
yeah
start there.
I think that's great. Yeah, because one of the risks, if I think apologetic works are fantastic, especially when addressing particular questions that person's already presenting to you. I think sometimes starting off with them, if there are no like serious deep questions yet,
You can commit the error that Dr. Montgomery warns about. You can give people problems that they didn't have.
Yeah.
And that is to be avoided at all costs. I've slipped into that before in conversations where you're just kind of going through the possible problems and you get a person's like, oh, I never thought of that. And you're like, great. I'm so glad I brought it up.
Well, I'll say that happens when you sort of, when you're in an apologetic conversation, you become a little bit aggressive too, because you're like, you get into that mode where you're trying to win and you're not just trying to sort of be evangelical anymore, which, you know, I'll full blown confess has happened to me.
Well, it's hard sometimes. Sometimes you're trying to share the faith with somebody who is, you know, they're just, whether it's talking about the faith or talking about taking out the trash, they're just kind of a cantankerous person.
Yeah, I'll say one of the ones that's really easy to accidentally argue that a person may not have even thought about is like problems with the text, right?
Absolutely. Or like
textual authority. All of a sudden you're arguing and you gave somebody a problem they did not have.
Or you can give people the problem of evil because it's so common that you just kind of bring it up.
Yep. I'll say I was in a, you know, I had Mormons coming to my house for a couple weeks. And sometimes these types of things can be a tool. So like with them, for instance, relying on how they understand their text to be authoritative or not, the Book of Mormon to be authoritative or not, puts a really big hole in sort of their worldview. They, for the most part, take it very for granted without any sort of
questioning
at all, that this is simply the word of God spoken through a prophet. And if you are sort of, as a Christian, talking to them, open to the idea of even just questions about how did we receive the scripture, that can be a big entry point. But let's say you do that to another Christian who you're sort of having like, who say believe something about the creation of the world that you don't. Or
yes,
something.
That's right.
You don't want to open up problems about Genesis to them. you know, that could be bad.
That could be really bad.
Yeah. So you got to kind of pick your battles and know your audience.
Let's avoid that.
And Montgomery has always emphasized listening, which is one of the, you know, that's one of the primary tasks of the apologist, is to listen so that you don't just sort of start fighting yourself a little bit in these conversations.
Yeah, well, his three sort of rules are don't take their problems too seriously. Don't, you know, fail to take their problems seriously enough and don't give them problems they already have.
Or don't, yeah.
You know, and so there's, if you kind of stick to that in a conversation like this, you'll be in good shape. And it's really easy to take their problem too seriously, to not take their problem seriously enough, or to give them a problem that they don't have. And so for the evangelist slash apologist, it's really good advice to try to avoid those things.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I have a technical question that I might as well just answer on the show, because I actually get questions about this all the time. This person simply asks, what kind of equipment do we use to record the show?
Do you remember the name of it? I don't.
Well, I'm looking at it. It's on your head. No, so like what kind of microphones and the like, which is a fair question. You know, a lot of people think about starting their own podcast. They hear a podcast that sounds pretty good, and they start to wonder how you're doing this. So we use it's called a broadcast headset microphone. We use the Audio-Technica brand of this, but you know, most microphone companies make one of these. It's called a broadcast headset. It's an XLR microphone. It's not like a USB microphone into a computer or something like that. And those get plugged into just various recorders, depending on where we are. So like on this emergency episode, we have a handheld audio recorder that has XLR inputs. In the studio, we have a much more complex mixing, auto mixing setup and stuff like that. But that's the gist of it. That's the basic equipment for those listening. The reason for that is because we are horribly trained on using microphones, like all of us. You know, professionals in the radio world get good at staying on top of their microphone and things like that. We never got the knack of that at the Thinking Fellows. In the OG days, that was partially because people were relaxed. We were sitting back, smoking a pipe, drinking, having, you know, and the goal of the show has always been sort of having a conversation. And when you do that, you start looking at the person you're talking to and maybe
turn your head
too much, you know. And so we just were doing a horrible job of staying on the microphones. And we got a lot of feedback that told us that. And so the easy solution for people who move around or, you know, just are not disciplined when it comes to the mic is to put a headset on that where the mic follows your head constantly.
I love the headsets. I really can't imagine going back.
Yeah, we've actually, you had like a 2-minute stint on the Truck Show podcast one time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they brought a very similar recording setup to ours. The one difference was literally the headsets. It was a handheld microphone. And, you know, we both talked into it, and it kind of made me uneasy. Like, yeah. It was very uncomfortable to talk into a freestanding microphone again. Because one of the other things that makes recording so easy with the headsets is that we hear the feedback automatically of how loud you sound in the recording.
A little harder on the portable one than we have. The one at the podcast studio is excellent for that.
Yeah, so you can immediately hear your voice, how it's coming out. You know if it needs to be louder or quieter, things like that. On somebody's handheld mic, I have no idea. I just hear myself talking in the room, right? And unless there's somebody monitoring it, the levels, they don't really, the person recording doesn't really know either.
Yeah.
This happened, you know, I was worried about this in Norway, for instance. We recorded with handheld mics one time in Norway on a panel this year. And I couldn't, the recorder had to be next to an audio system, which was separated by like 10 feet from the table we were at. So I couldn't really monitor the levels of the microphones just to know how things were going. And they were wireless microphones. And so I was afraid we were sort of going to have a little bit of an unusable audio situation on our hands. Mm-hmm. And we didn't. We got kind of lucky with that, even though
people stepped up.
I was super nervous about it. And so, yeah, that goes into the show. We have to think about those kinds of situations a lot, especially, and it's good to push our boundaries on these kinds of things. Like the Norway panel made me see that we could do panel things, like if we traveled to other events or churches in the future as well, and that I'd be able to consistently capture them. I have a little more faith in that equipment now that I've seen it work. So, you know, we don't do phone calls right now, but in the future we may need to do that.
Yeah, we're getting some pushback, you know, because we have some people we want on the show that just can't make it to California.
Yeah, and that's becoming, you know, in the early days it was less and less a problem, and now it's sort of more and more strained and figuring out how to do that. So we are trying to, you know, we are trying to stretch our limits if you've wondered about those kinds of things in the past. And, you know, we will try to add improvements to the show and various recording situations to the show as need be. One of the exciting things for an established podcast is the increased opportunities to do live podcasting. And I say this because it's like a stepping stone where these conversations that you have sort of with yourselves here, like at the table, but that people at home are joining in on. I think that's one of the real appeal of podcasts in general, is that for a lot of people, they get to feel like they're part of the conversation. You can sort of join in your head. You can answer along to questions.
Yeah.
I do that when I'm listening to podcasts. I like listening to podcasts with other people, like on car rides, because I can sort of pause it and you can start making the conversation your own with the person you're driving with. I do that a lot with like the political podcasts I listen to, but the, you know, the live show breaks down that barrier where now a large group of people who have listened to the show, say like at Here We Still Stand and things like that, get to actually be in person for the conversation in certain circumstances, get to ask questions, get to talk to us after the show, get to talk to us before the show. And those conversations that you have during, before, after, and throughout the year may influence how we do that show, and people's voices actually get to sort of merge with ours in that. And it's a much more fun thing to do, actually, I think.
I like the live shows.
Yeah. I think like the ones in Norway have been fun. The one we did in the bar in Norway this time, we passed the headsets around like three or four times. That's, you know, that's really fun because it breaks down this barrier where we're sort of like these experts sitting up on a high horse and,
content experts.
Yeah, and I don't like that. I like it being a sort of a mutual effort where we're helping to drive a conversation that people want to or need to have. And that's one of the fun things about these Q&A episodes too. So, okay, the next question. Let's see here. I had one on, well, I think we did a whole episode on this a while ago, but it wasn't because this person asked. So this is a new spin on this one. But the question is about the centrality of justification to Lutheranism and to Christianity in general, and saying that there's been some talk about how universal objective justification is taking people away from the church, is an error in the church, and if we could speak to that on any level.
So let me understand this again. This is somebody asking that the idea of justification as the article on which the church stands or falls is doing what?
Well, so number one, is that as central to Lutheranism as we propose, or
yes,
as has been proposed?
Yes, it is.
Which we dedicated a whole episode to called Does the Church Still Stand or Fall on Justification?
Yeah.
Where we covered this question. But then the second part of this question is universal objective justification an error?
No, I mean, it's taught in the scriptures. This is, you could list many verses in favor of this, but if you just stuck with John 3:16, I think you kind of get both sides of this, right? God so loved the whole world that he gave his only son. Why does he give his only son? He gave his son to be a ransom for sin, for the whole world. Then the second half of that verse is that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. The idea of objective, subjective justification, you know, it's a distinct systematic category that I think if it's taught out of context, it can be seen as erroneous, right? That out of context with outside of the teaching of salvation by grace through faith on account of Christ, it seems like universalism, you know, that Christ died for the sins of the whole world and that objectively his death pays for everything. Kind of sounds like universalism, but it's not, because it's not taught on its own. It's not taught as a sole category. It's taught within the idea of justification as taught in scriptures, which includes both aspects. Mm-hmm. Christ dying for the sins of the whole world, and that the benefits of his death and resurrection go to those who by faith cling to him alone. You know, and it's, I think the problem is, the problem is a problem of parsing, and that we really like to sort of get hooked up on one thing that we've read, perhaps out of context, perhaps as a standalone, was supposed to be included as a greater set of ideas pointing towards one end, and we can say, "Oh, that doesn't sound right." Well, on its own, objective justification doesn't sound right because it's all about God's grace and mercy for all of His creation.
It sounds like, I think maybe some of the pushback to people is it sounds like universalism.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Is it? But and taught on its own, it can be, but when it's taught correctly, it's not never taught on its own.
Yeah, it's tied to specific faith, specific declaration.
Well, it's tied to the greater category in systematics of justification, mm-hmm. which is going to encompass both what we categorize as objective for everyone and subjective for you justification.
It's the by grace part and then the through faith.
Yeah, so by grace through faith. Thought of simply, Christ's death paid the price for all sin. Period, right? If you stop there, that's objective justification. Christ's death paid the price for all sin. He doesn't have to go and die, every time individually again, when you do a new sin or when every individual comes to faith, right? Christ's death on its own, his one-time death, paid the price for all sin. The question then comes up, well, why is it then that some... and the scriptures are said that they will have faith and be redeemed and go to heaven, and others will not, and they will be damned. And that's where the through faith comes in, is that through God-given faith, right? Through faith that comes to the sinner through the proclaimed word, or the word connected to the water and the sacrament of baptism, and through which the Holy Spirit works to engender faith, turn hearts of stone into hearts of flesh so that they can believe. And when they do, literally that belief is a grabbing hold of the benefits of Christ, the promises of Christ, right? What are those promises? That you are justified before Him, that you are part of the family of God, that you are redeemed, that you are made new, that you will live again with Him one day in paradise, that you will rise again from the dead just as He did. All these now, these benefits are now yours.
Yeah. I think that's a great... simple answer to this question. I think I've gotten that as an email before. That was a Facebook message this time. It's definitely an interesting conversation coming up from Lutherans. I'm happy to sort of dive into that occasionally.
I think it's
a Q&A episode.
One of the things that happens sometimes is that people, and I think blogs have done this a little bit, people can now run into like very specific systematic categories that are not within the context of a greater systematic work. Right, so you can run into a concept even in a blog or on a podcast of somebody talking about objective justification, but it's not put into the greater context of justification as it's taught in the scriptures generally.
I also think it's one of the things we were saying here too is like taught on its own, or that this doctrine can be perverted. Any doctrine really can, mm-hmm. and so I'm not surprised to find that somebody has critiqued a particular way somebody has taught objective justification, right? Because it can be taught in such a manner as to be an error.
Absolutely. And like you said, any doctrine can.
Any doctrine can. But that doesn't mean you just abandon the categories then because it was taught incorrectly by
That's
somebody.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, predestination can be taught erroneously. That doesn't mean you abandon the concept of God's predestination.
Yeah. So I think that's a pretty solid answer to that. So next question. This is about distinguishing or dealing with external sins versus internal sins. And is there a way in which we can do this badly? Is there a way in which an appropriate way to do this? And I think the example here is essentially saying, hey, there are sins of people, say, in my congregation or even people I know that are very obvious, right? External, physical in nature, whatever. Then there are the people who are sinning quietly, right? And who seem to get away with it. Are we right to be more harsh on those people who are sinning externally, or is there a way to even balance this? Should we even deal with this issue at all?
Well, it's difficult. When I teach this in class, one of the things I say is that the problem with judging the sins of other people is that we can only see the external sins, number one. Mm-hmm. And so the funny thing is we might think we're judging them harshly, for all their external sins. But in reality, we're probably not judging them harshly enough because we don't even see all the thoughts and the feelings that are sinful in every way. But the bigger problem that leads to sanctimoniousness on the part of the person doing the judging is that anytime you measure something, you'll be using some yardstick to be the measurer, mm-hmm. right? And typically the yardstick that we use to measure somebody's sin, which again, we can only see their outward sin.
So
is ourselves.
Yeah.
And how well we think we're doing. Or the best, say it this way, the best person we know, which is usually us, but the best person we know, and yet that person is still a sinner. We rarely use the ultimate guide to this, which is perfection. Mm-hmm. Right? Christ doesn't give us like gradations of good and say, judge by this. He says, be ye holy as I am holy. Unless a man lives a life that exceeds the holiness of the Pharisees, mm-hmm. he will not find eternal life. Well, there's only been one person that's done that, and that's Christ. And all measurements against him fall short. So you're looking at this person who externally, by your current measurer, which is you, is a sinner. And you're saying, man, how come they get away with it all the time? Where if you were going to look from Christ's perspective as he's looking at you, he'd say, man, how does that dude get away with it all the time?
Yeah.
Right? And this doesn't even take into account the fact that when Christ talks about sin to people who ask him these kind of questions, he usually makes the judgment even harder than just be outwardly better than the Pharisees.
The Sermon on the Mount is, the prime example of
right.
this, where he sort of, he makes the force of the law 10 times what it is yeah. in the Decalogue.
If you've ever looked at a woman with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery with her. If you've ever looked at a man and cursed him for being alive, you've committed murder against that man. I mean, you can't make the law harder. And that's the way he's saying, judge this not by the external things that you see, but judge this by that and deeper than that, by the things that you're thinking, which means that nobody measures up. Mm-hmm. Now, the objection to what I just said usually comes in. The classic objection comes in when one says, then, well, does that mean that we stop trying to be outwardly good? No, right? And Paul deals with this in Romans 5. Then shall we go on sinning so that grace can abound? His answer is, certainly not. Mm-hmm. And the certainly not in the text is like, that's a dumb question.
Yeah.
Because it's ridiculous to ask that, now that I've received this gift that I didn't deserve, should I go on speaking against the gift? Should I go on thinking against the gift? Should I go on destroying the gift?
Yes.
His answer is no, absolutely not. That's ridiculous. But we like to make our motivation for doing something, for trying harder, reward. Well, the reward has been taken care of. Now your reason for trying harder is that now that you are in the family, to be part of the family,
yeah.
to act like part of the family.
Yeah, it's
not that if you don't, you're going to get kicked out, but that it's better to be in the family when acting as part of the family than it is to be in the family while acting like a stranger.
Well, and even acting sort of aggressive towards the family or something like that. You can drive, part of this, I think, also gets really caught up in looking at that particular individual in sin. But if we think about, love your neighbor as yourself as sort of the culmination of the law too, you can also see how these sins are not just about what that person is doing, but maybe the people he's driving away from the faith or
well, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Mm-hmm. The second's like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. And then everybody who's honest with themselves, like, I'm out.
Yeah. I think part of this deals with, It's obvious that Christians are feeling tension in the world right now, too, right? There's just a lot of political, ethical things going on in the world right now, which make things feel tense. And one of the, I think, temptations constantly is to, instead of to distinguish ourselves by that thing, by what we have faith in, by what we proclaim, by what we teach and preach, is to distinguish ourselves by what we do versus what the world does. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's a very, very easy habit to get into. And for, I think it's bad for two reasons. Number one, it's, you stop the endeavor to preach God's word right. outside of you,
yep.
which is the only way it comes to the world is yep. by coming outside of us. And then number two, you also start to isolate people who in your congregation actually partake in what you view as the sins of the world,
right?
Sort of not the sins of the church. And, you know, maybe it is quiet. Maybe it's things other people in church don't know about. And you're sort of not, you're maybe not creating a space where they can confess those sins anymore.
Well, I mean,
because the forgiveness is withheld.
What should we get from this? The sins of the heart are as ubiquitous as the external sins, which we can see. All of these need to be confessed. All of these need to be absolved. Christ has died for all of these. We do not attempt to take advantage of his gracious gift towards us in our justification apart from works. We acknowledge that we've been made part of his family by his work alone, and we seek to act like part of the family, not as strangers or enemies. And when we fail, we flee to his cross again for redemption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's about as good as it gets here on this. So, okay. Probably the last question. Well, we'll see how this goes. But we have questions about the Catechism Project. I don't know when we started talking about this. Over a year ago.
I stopped talking about it because I realized that we dropped the ball on it.
But I've now gotten, I've got probably like 4 or 5 emails.
Oh, okay.
Hey,
what's up?
What's up with the creating the poster, focusing on the 6 chief parts of the catechism? What are you guys waiting on?
Well, here's the deal. We have a very talented employee who's our creative director, who was the one helping me work on this, and we made some progress on it. And then it became necessary to redo our website, and he dove headfirst into that for about a year and a half. The website is currently not perfect and still needs some fixing, but we're rearranging some assets to give more help on bringing in other developers to fix some of the issues with the website, which would mean that I'm hoping that our creative director will be freed up to spend some more time on this again. I would say that I could commit to having at least one of the posters done and ready for sale probably in the next 6 months. It's taken 10 years to get any momentum on this. It's a difficult thing. It's a difficult task. And I know it sounds easy, and some people have pulled it off, like Fort Wayne Seminary has pulled it off a little bit with their posters, but it's just not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that is as attractive to hang in the dining room as is good in, you know, that way aesthetically as it is in content. And that's difficult. That is difficult.
Yeah, I think we've tried to do this with everything at 1517. We've tried to make the visual quality high, and it's not just for the sake of like vanity that you want good looking things. You know, I think one of the reasons, I don't know how much of it can be blamed, I'm not going to give a percentage to it, but one of the reasons, you know, Lutheranism seems pretty foreign to the world is because the stuff is all designed to be in our churches with people who are already familiar with
yeah.
it and what it looks like and feels like. And that's a difficult mold to break. It's a difficult, I don't think it's a thing you can ask a church to break, because what they're called to do is to
preach to the church.
Is preach to the church. And even like synodical tools and stuff, their goal shouldn't be to make a hymnal that looks attractive to the outside world. Their goal should be to make a hymnal that works in...
It's functional.
That's functional inside churches, right?
Yeah.
And so that's actually one of the voids that I think 1517 fills well, because we can make things that sort of, yeah, look really good, that look clickable, linkable, readable to outsiders who get them to step foot in the door. And then these things that are designed to be functional and pragmatic for other reasons actually become familiar to them over time.
Yep.
Right. So, you know, I cast no shade on the burgundy hymnal and catechism and Book of Concord and all of that matches and is supposed to look a particular way. I just think when we do things like, say, make catechism posters, they're not going to be designed to be like in a pastor's office.
I've always said with these that they have to be attractive enough so that your wife won't object if you hang it on the wall in her house.
Yeah.
That's always been the, since before I was with 1517, that's always been the goal with these catechism posters. And that is the hard part. It's difficult to find the artists that can do it. It's difficult to get the text to fit well within the artistry. In our case, we're trying for our woodcut style. It's difficult to get the sizing right so that you can fit all of the wording in a poster that can be read from like 10 feet away still.
We're even trying to get the wording right.
Yeah.
One of the things is that like there's some really good translations of the Small Catechism that are wooden. There are some okay translations that are like really fluid for memorization's sake. And we're trying to also strike a balance there in what we do with that text so that it's very, very accurate, right?
And then the goal is to keep the cost down.
Yeah.
So that's where we are. We made a lot of headway on Ten Commandments. But then our creative director got sidetracked with website stuff. But I think we can get him refocused on it.
Well, cool. I think it's a good project. I think there's other catechism projects that could probably grow out of this as well, because once you lay the groundwork for things like art and translations and all those sorts of things, sort of your publishing abilities even expand with what you can do with these. I think in addition to something like posters, I've noticed a need for sort of a catechism laid out for devotional use.
Yeah.
We've had, Jim Nesigan has, talked at Here We Still Stand and Thinking Fellows and other places, kind of countlessly about how he's used the catechism as a devotional tool. John Pless's book, Praying Luther's Small Catechism, right, is a large encouragement to this as well. And one of the things I've found is some of the modern catechisms have a lot of stuff that isn't the catechism, which isn't bad. It's usually for the purpose of catechesis in the church, right? It's got extra questions, it's as extra texts, which I'll go side by side with texts that are already in the Small Catechism, extra Bible verses to go read and consider, and things like that. Questions written by, great theologians to help you learn the catechism. But as a devotional tool, sometimes those things get in the way. And so, but on the other hand, there are slimmed down versions of the catechism that are just a plain text, but most of them are really cheap paperback. They're not really something that you think is going to last 20 years that you can give to your kids or grandkids.
Keep on your shelf forever.
So I think there's a need for that too, that may, also develop out of this catechism project and the like. So just stay tuned on that. I know, sometimes we get really excited about projects, and because, the director of 1517 is on the show, we maybe blurt things before they're even pre-production. I've done that as well with certain things with books. Just stay tuned. We're diligently working on it. We're glad that there are people excited out there for these kinds of projects. We will definitely update you when things are ready to be put on sale and to start ordering them. And I think that covers about as many questions as we can get in this episode without going over time. Hey, thank you for listening to this episode. I'm still, we really need more reviews over here at the Thinking Fellows podcast. So if you go to iTunes podcast or the Apple podcast app, you can review the Thinking Fellows. 5-star reviews are absolutely the most helpful because, they help us get bumped up in sort of the catalog of shows out there. We have some episodes that show up pretty instantaneously if you search something. So if you search C.S. Lewis, Thinking Fellows is like right there, right at the top for our episode on C.S. Lewis, which is awesome. But one of the things we've struggled with is just getting high in the general directory of podcasts on religion and spirituality. And that's because this is a category filled with aggressive competition from televangelists essentially have, they've converted all of their years of preaching into podcasts and things like that. And they
can we air quote that preaching?
Yeah, we can air quote that preaching. And it honestly dominates the religion and spirituality category. Thinking Fellows is, from what I can see, the most downloaded weekly format Lutheran podcast. And it would be really cool to dump into like the top 10 more frequently than we ever have. We get into the top 50 quite frequently, usually for like an hour at a time, when there's like a mass surge of downloads because a new episode comes out. But it would be really cool this year to be able to be on that front page of that directory again, like we were the first year when we were in the new and noteworthy section. And so the only way to do that is if we get a lot of reviews. And I think, you know, my goal for the end of 2020 would be 1,000 reviews. And I think if we can get 1,000 five-star reviews on the Thinking Fellows podcast, and, you know, I'm working on some other things to expand the listener base, I think that will really help push us up in these, in just the iTunes directory, which corresponds to other directories and other podcasting apps. So even if you don't listen on iTunes, that work actually spreads across the whole industry because most podcasting apps are using the directory from Apple. So we really appreciate people spending the time to help us out in that way. So thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.